my name's Geraldine McKenna, and I'm from Our Lady Secondary School in Cookstown. And my project here is investigating different levels of calcium and the effect of it on the laying hen. And I'll tell you what I've done.
Yeah.
Well, I used a control group of four hens, and I had another group of four hens on the low calcium. The standard ration is 3.5% calcium, and the low calcium ration is 1.1% calcium. And you can see here the effects of it, decreased egg size and decreased eggshell strength, and being soft.
The eggshell, in fact, collapses eventually.
Yeah, that's right.
Through lack of calcium.
Yeah. It's very, and this shows that, it's really essential. Calcium is really essential to the eggshell.
And that's what you set out to prove, and that's what you proved.
Yes, it's proved, yes, and statistically as well.
Well, did your hens suffer in the process?
Well, they noticed rubbery beaks and their toes spread out, and they molted. But that was really all,
And after this experiment was over, you brought them back to life and vigour, presumably by feeding them plenty of calcium.
Yeah, and they recovered.
Patrick Grady, Community School, Valcarra, County Donegal.
And what's your project, Patrick?
Twin solenoid motor. It works off a battery. A DC voltage comes in, DC current comes in, and when the T-piece is in a position here, it engages this solenoid. There's two solenoids. This solenoid is engaged, it will pull and change the T over to the other solenoid. Therefore, it's engaged. We'll keep moving like this. It's a bit noisy, but that could be cured. Also, another use for the solenoid is the
Wait now, is this a new invention as far as you're concerned?
Well, as far as I know, I don't know if anyone else had made one of these before.
And what practical application can you see for it?
Well, I can see it driving simple things that ordinary motors can drive.
Static motors rather than mobile ones.
Ordinary motors. I can sit like this. Belt can be attached to the crank wheel.
Yes.
Or other clog wheels can be attached on it, and it will drive it. Just the same as any simple ordinary motor.
And what will the cost of driving be?
Just an ordinary 12-volt battery drives it. It's very easy in current. It takes 2 amps current for each solenoid.
Would you intend to patent this?
No, I don't think so. I'm a schoolboy and I don't have time for things like that. It's just a school project.
I didn't need come to Mercy Clinical to County Cork.
This is a very interesting project here, Zadine. The habits and non-habits of a bovine herd. What were some of the things you came up with in it?
I established that there was such a thing as society status in a herd of cows. I watched them as they went out to the field every day, and I established that one cow was always in front, and she was had established herself as the superior member of the herd. And I then examined her temperament, and it was nervy one. When she was touched by humans, she was very nervy, and I didn't record her milk yield, and it was very inconsistent, as you can see in the graft. And then I discovered that there was also a back marker. That's the one that's always last going a gate or going from field to field. And she was very quiet and very consistent milker. And also looked at the background of the leader, and she'd been reared at home, which had given herself time to establish herself within the herd, whereas the other one had been bought in England, and therefore she found it hard to settle down when she was switched to our farm. And then I discovered that if you ever watched a group of people going in the gate, they move in 2 semicircles, whereas if you watch a herd of cows, they move in a uniform rectangle. And this seems a much more practical way of moving than what humans do. And then I discovered that by pure uniformity and consistency, you can condition a cow to react to human voice. I got this cow, and every time it came to her feeding time, I called her name Skippy. And after 5 days, I got a very positive response. She came towards me. And then I stopped this process for 2 months. And when the 2 months had elapsed, I once again resumed this process. And she again remembered the name. And then I decided that I'd play music, see what would affect their milk yield. And therefore, out of 40 cows, there was 5 that weren't affected. The rest of them were, with an average of 2 pounds increase, with about when the music was played rather than when it wasn't played.
An increase of what?
Of 2 pounds of milk. And then I said that maybe it is the weather that's causing this increase, or maybe the grazing. So I housed 10 cows, and I gave them both. I gave all of them the same amount of feeding and the same conditions every day. And I still got an average increase of about 2 pounds. So then I decided what kind of music would bring them better increase. So I played one melodious tune, and I played it for about 5 days, and I got an average increase of 4 pounds. Whereas when I played, you know, rock music, I'd only increase about 3 pounds.
My name's Paul Nolan, and I've come from Mide Park College, Clondalkin.
What's your project?
It's on a new meteor shower, which I think occurred during the month of August. I observed it during 1976 and 77, and at this time of year there was no other project, or no other meteor shower recorded in any books that I had read on it.
Was it a certain segment of the sky that you watch constantly? Yes,
Up here on this chart here, I showed the point from the sky, which is between Ursa Minor and Draco, which they came from, and in the manner of a meteor shower.
Well, do you think this is something that other people have not noticed?
Well, the meteors themselves from the shower might have been noticed by some people, but weren't taken in as a shower. But they came in the manner of a shower, and it might not have been noticed before because the meteors mightn't have been there before. They might have only gathered into an orbit around the sun to intersect with the Earth each year after that, from 1976-77.
Will you say you observed this first in 1976?
Yes.
And then 12 months later you looked for it again?
Yes.
How long did it last?
8 days. 8 to 9 days. In 1976 it was 8 days, in 1977 it was 9 days. I looked from the day before in 1977, after the day I noticed this in 1976.
Well, have you drawn this to the attention of astronomers generally?
Yes, the two astronomers mostly, because they'd be who'd be interested in it, or people studying meteorics.
Declan Murray, and I go to school at Marymount College, Carrick and Shannon.
Declan, your project relates to trying to save County Leitrim. Is it your native county?
Yes.
What's the big problem? Drainage?
Drainage. The farms are overgrown with rushes and they're not drained properly. So we decided that we'd set out to see if there was enough information available for the farmers to drain their land properly.
And is there?
There is, yeah.
But at what cost to the farmers?
Well, it's... I wouldn't really know. It's very dear, though. It's roughly about... for a farm of about 35 acres, it's 40,000, something around that, to drain it.
£40,000?
Yeah, because you have to use mold drainage.
I thought the big problem in Leitrim was the subsoil, the marl, as they call it.
Yeah, daub, yeah. It's a problem, you see. No drainage you're working at other than mold drainage, because you have to crack the soils at the side. And it won't work unless you... when you crack the soil and you have to put gravel chips in the drain, or else the drain will close in after a year and a half and you'll have to get another one done. And it's quite expensive, though. And it
has to be done to virtually the whole county, doesn't it?
Yeah, virtually the whole county.
My name is Anne Keating and I go to Santa Sabina in Sutton. And I did this project because I love trees and I hope to pursue a career in forestry. And there's a park beside us, and they had 153 elms in the park of different species. And I did a survey on the percentage that were diseased, and I found 18 were diseased. And one of the species, Ulmus caupinifolia, I probed, you know, there was 45 of these in the park, and none of these were diseased, so that proves that they are resistant. And then,
this is one particular strain of elm, is it?
Yeah, yes. And then I discussed biological control. I think that this combined with a strict sanitation program seems to be the only answer. And the biological control would be the itch Newman fly, as this eats the bark beetle, because the other methods of control, such as insecticides, like they're only practical on a large scale program, and it depends on weather conditions for the use of them. And then systemic fungicides, they're very expensive and then they don't always work. And there are some resistant strains of alum that have been discovered, but these sometimes are not as picturesque, or they can be more susceptible to other kinds of alum disease. And then I compared the weather charts to statistics of disease trees, and it is known that hot weather does cause the disease to spread more rapidly because of transpiration, and the fungal spores are brought more quickly up to the leaves. But I showed this by the statistics I found in between 1975 and 76, and the weather reports of 1975 and 1976.
This ichneumon fly that you suggest could be a possible solution, is that found in Ireland?
No, well, it's mainly in the United States. They're doing more research into the possibility of this. It's mainly America that are involved with this fly.
And this fly actually feeds on the
alum bark beetle. Yeah, there's two kinds of the bark beetles. There's Scolytus scolytus and Scolytus multistratus. They're the two kinds of the disease.
Seamus Fanning of the De La Salle College, Waterford. Yes, tell me, Seamus.
Well, the pyramid has been in our midst for centuries, and really we've never noticed the effects to which it can be put. So we've had a lot of information, but it has been lost over many centuries during the Dark Ages, which were ages of persecution by the Christians. So we've had to start from scratch really again and build up our knowledge of the pyramid.
Why should the pyramid have special force and special power?
It's really a mystery, because we don't know where they come from, you know. We know that they have effects on certain substances, but we don't know why, really. It's all to do with the atmosphere, light, and all, and direction.
And this is what creates this mummifying effect?
Yeah, it's to do with the concentration of power at certain points, and that mummifies various objects, for instance, the king's body or meat.
So tell me about your experiment.
Well, I've worked on milk mostly, and I've worked on one experiment with cream. This was a very interesting experiment, because I expected to get cheese from the cream within a period of time, and within a period of over 8 days, from the time I put the cream into the pyramid to the time I came back and checked it again, I had a cheese, a very rich cheese, which had a very rich odour from it. While I also put a jar outside the pyramid to compare with the one inside, and it had gone very, very sour. So that was a very interesting experiment in itself.
But is this not something you could sell to the milk companies?
Well, if they're interested, I mean, I'm here for the next
few
days.
Have you ever heard of a milk company experimenting with this kind of thing?
On the continent, they do a lot with it, but not in Ireland.
With pyramids?
With pyramids, yeah.
And your pyramid is simply made of plastic sheeting, is it?
Yeah. It's just a simple construction.
And you put the milk in, the cream in under
that?
The
cream goes in under the apex at exactly one third the height from the midpoint of the base. And it's here that the power more or less concentrates. That's what gives us the effects that we get on them.
And there is no physical reason why this should be so, that you know?
No.
Why it should be one third from the base, for example?
Well, the light comes through at different angles. One light can come through the walls of the pyramid, and it will be reflected around the pyramid at different angles to the walls. And it just seems to concentrate around a third up from the base. You know, it seems to have something to do with gravity.
I'm Donald MacDonald from Crescent College Comprehensive in Limerick.
How long have you been coming here, Donald?
This is my fifth year entering.
How have you done before?
I've picked up a few awards. I was runner-up last year, and I won Junior Chemistry the year before, and highly commended at the year before that. And the first year was a bit of experience.
So it's been a progression?
It has,
A happy progression.
Happy progression,
you.
Yes.
And what's your project this year?
Well, this year's project is a study of the impact which discharge has on the biota of the Shannon River at Limerick. And it's just a long name for saying that I'm trying to see what the effects of pollution are on the ecology of the river. And I've done biological and chemical monitoring and correlated the two of them to find what the effects are.
Were your previous projects on similar themes?
Well, they were more on the chemical analysis side, but this year's project is definitely enlarged in the chemical side, but it's more of a biological monitoring than chemical monitoring.
You've always been interested in the Shannon?
Yes, well, the Shannon is right beside me, so it's been readily available to me.
Have you had reaction from local people on your...
Yes, the County Council have been very interested in my work, and, not only that, but local people in the area have been interested. There are some people who have brought me out in boats and things like that to see the river and that. And generally people show an interest in pollution, but they don't have shown enough an interest to do anything about it or be worried about it, really.
How bad is it?
Well, it's progressively, let's say, it's not very bad. It's bad in spots. It's very bad in spots. But the dilution factor of the river seems to lessen the pollution as leaving the town, which is to be expected. But it's progressively getting worse, and this can be seen by doing a project over 4 years. The population of Limerick now is around 60,000 people, with no sewage effluent at all. So that's all going into the river. When the population increases to 120,000, what are we going to have? The river is steadily getting worse. At some stages, the river now, I've proved, the river now, at night time in the summer, is unsuitable for migratory fish. They cannot migrate up to the spawn.
Do you point the finger at anyone for polluting the river?
Well, yes, at ourselves. Because it's sewage discharge that is doing the main damage, doing the most damage. And technically, anybody who dumps sewage is violating the law, but we don't think about this when we're flushing our toilets or whatever it is. But everything that goes down that sewer, or down the sewer pipe, oil or anything, is all going into the Shannon. And what we really need now is a sewage treatment in Limerick. The industrial effluents are there at the present, but with the new Act, the Water Pollution Act of 1977, when this is implemented, it'll stop water pollution from factories, anyway. It'll make them... It regulates dumping of sewage, and you need licences to dump now and all this.
Do you intend to make science your living?
Well, considering it now, I would, yes. But, I'm open to change, but I would like to work in limnology or bacteria or... marine biology.
What are your chances of picking up a prize this year?
Oh, well, as good a chance as everybody else, but I'd like to pay. I'd like to see what I can do anyway.
Have the judges been with you?
They have, yes. I think they're away now to discuss the findings.
But, so you're at the keeping the fingers crossed.
Keeping
stage.
The fingers crossed the five.
And Donald MacDonald kept his fingers crossed to some effect. He turned out to be the individual overall winner. Apart from the young scientists, many of their teachers and advisers were at the RDS in Ballsbridge early this month.
I'm John Fortune from St Peter's College, Wexford. This year, St Peter's College have a record number of young scientists here in the exhibition. In fact, I think the best represented school. We've 10 particular projects and one group project.
Is it only your bright boys who come in to the RDS?
Up to a few years ago, yes, our bright physicians and chemists, etc. But because of the introduction of the group project, there is now a greater interest in things like sociology, how people live, etc. And that gives a chance to the less bright boys. But definitely in the strict sciences, it has to be the bright boys, I think.
You say you have a big representation here, but that presumably is the tip of a rather large iceberg. Probably you had a lot of projects from a lot of people in your school. And you turned down a number.
Yes. Well, in fact, I'm not so sure of the number who went forward, but I think most of the boys, or the groups who went forward, are actually here today. I think maybe one who was working the project for the last few years decided to wait maybe for next year. I'm not so sure on that. But
as a science teacher, how do you regard this? Is it worthwhile?
Well, in fact, I don't teach science myself, but as a person studying sociology... And, you know, watching the other things, I think, yes. A boy said to me last year, who did the young scientist, said to me, no, he said, the most valuable thing I've done during my Living Cert studies has been the young scientist. In meeting people, especially here at the RDS, especially the two public days, on Saturday and Sunday, having to talk to people and to put forward views and to deal with people. It's not only great now, but it's great when they go to look for a job, when they go for interviews, etc., that they can... stand their own in public. This is very, very important. In other words, not just a science, it's discipline training for life as well.
Brother Corn from St. Peter's, CBS, Craigan, and Derry.
You teach science, yeah?
Science, geography, social studies.
What do you think of this RDS venture?
I think it's quite good. Like, Aer Lingus have put quite an amount of money and expertise into the running of it. We've been coming down for 5 years now, and the children have... there's something to aim for, to see what other boys and girls can achieve, boys and girls of their age group. It's expertly put on, and it's also a platform which they wouldn't otherwise have.
Do you feel this is the kind of discipline that school children need at this age to see a project through on their own?
Yes and no. Like, just talking from my point of view, quite a number of children who were initially keen on the idea and took up a project dropped it after a certain amount of time. And some of them dropped them within the last 6 or 8 weeks, which isn't too nice for Aer Lingus. But the weaker type of kids, like I'm teaching in a secondary school in the north, secondary modern, they're not encouraged when they see the high standard.
Do you think it's only the cream of the students
here? Yeah, see, the whole system is taken up with that cream down here. You know, for examinations, etc. For example, the curriculum is geared towards the 10% or less who go on to university or training college. This type of exhibition here, you could say, is geared in the same way towards the cream of the children who are good at maths, social sciences, science generally.
Would there be any interest in bringing the average student or the below average student, would there be any interest in their work?
Well, for example, I would be, I have a hang up on that. Like I teach in a school, a mixed ability school, where we don't get the cream, even though we have done, we have had a few prizes here, and we've been very well treated by Aer Lingus, etc. But I think that's where a lot of frustration arises in education, where children, this 90%, if you like, they are not being catered for, and they don't get the limelight, and the 10% seem to be get all this going for them.
Sister Margaret Mary, come to Mercy Clanachilty.
Francis Galvin, Presentation Convent, Bendham.
What's your view of this exhibition, this RDS thing?
Well, I feel that it gives them a lot of experience even to come here. Now, I don't think it, takes over completely for the more exceptional student, because I feel that, well, if a pupil really wants to do something and is interested enough in doing it and working towards it, that is experience for her, you know. So I have only one junior one here this year, and like she's very quiet, but like I feel that this is doing something great for her, you know, even mixing in that.
Yes, personality-wise.
Apart from education. You know, she's from Cape Clear, so...
A rather remote area.
Yes, yeah.
Again, I feel that it's great experience for them, and I feel that... if they express any little bit of interest at all in doing a project, that I encourage them. And I find it very, very difficult to say no, even though at times I have to, because the project mightn't be up to standard. And the responsibility is really put back on us teachers to decide whether or not the projects are up to standard initially. And I find that very difficult to do. And I do encourage them to come along, and I try to have a number of projects every year.
I find that a number of the projects are simply expositions of known fact with no great evidence of original thought. Would that be fair?
That's probably true to a certain extent, but I feel that maybe in the junior sections that they could give more recognition, we'll say, to descriptive projects, because in fairness, you know, even to get the children interested in science, if they can't describe something... Well, you can't expect them to kind of go in and do scientific work on the whole thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel that the descriptive ones are important as well, even though they don't seem to give that much recognition to them, I suppose,
yeah,
you know?
That's true. I feel that Aer Lingus, I don't know if they're being fair to the participants in general, because I feel an awful lot of projects are... It is obvious to me that the teachers have done an awful lot of work on them. Mm. And I'm wondering if Aer Lingus are... They must be aware of it. But I'm wondering, in their adjudication, are they being fair to the exhibitors? Because to me it's obvious where teachers' work is being shown.
Certainly, you know? I'll ask them on your behalf.
Thank you.
I'm speaking to two of the judges of group projects, Dr. J.A. Scott and Mr. P. Stott. What was the general standard like, Dr. Scott?
Well, this year I think the standard was almost as good as last year, I think it's fair to say. The winning projects, of course, did achieve a very high standard. But there is a tendency for a lot of the group projects, and this is a thing Mr. Stark would probably agree, tending to be the survey type project.
Yes.
And the scientific content of some of these survey ones we must query.
This is what I was wondering about. It struck me walking around the exhibition that a great number of the exhibits are simply of known data presented, no original work involved.
Yes, that is a very true comment. There are, of course, with the better presentations, original thought, original work, but there are a few comments that I think I would like to make. I think most of the competitors could improve their report writing and the tabulation of data. It's often quite a lengthy business for us to wade through vast amounts of material. A lot of improvement could be made there.
In the presentation field?
In the presentation, in their report books, more so than the actual large-scale presentation on their stands.
I noticed, too, incidentally, that the standard of literacy was not terribly high.
Well, I will agree with you there, and I'm glad you said that.
Yes. Another point I think I would like to bring up is the question of, again, talking about these survey-type projects. They gather an awful lot of data, but they don't seem to have to analyse the data, how to extract the information that is there. I think they draw conclusions from it which are not scientifically valid, I think, in some cases.
I promised to put to you a point raised by a science teacher whom I spoke to, who was wondering whether the judges distinguished between what was a pupil's work and what, in fact, was a teacher's work.
Well, this we certainly try to do. We question all the exhibitors, and I think, you know, by asking a few leading questions, you can very quickly find out the exhibitor or the child who knows his stuff and who's been taught. But, I had a case in point in one of the prize winners in the group thing. I tried to lead them slightly astray, but they were very quick to see that I was going wrong, and they brought me back. You know, and this shows that they understood the project. I did this deliberately. They were one of the top prize winners. And I tried to see, by just bringing them a little bit off the topic, would they follow me or would they actually come back onto the correct path, which they did. I was very delighted to see.
The group projects embrace many scientific disciplines. Do you have great difficulty? Do you, as a chemist, push for a chemistry exhibit to win, or does a physicist do the same?
No, I don't think we do. We have a very large panel of judges embracing all the various disciplines, and I think we work quite well as a team in that way. Obviously, we're very happy to see a very good project within our own discipline, but certainly we don't push unreasonably. We do have our squabbles when it comes to the ultimate decisions, but they're always resolved in, one hopes, the best possible way. There's one thing that perhaps would be worth saying, and that is that in many of the group projects, it appears to us that there is one person that is really doing all the work, and there's a few passengers coming along. We would like to see all the participants in a group, each taking on a particular facet of the work, preferably to have a multidisciplinary approach to the project.
This exhibition is becoming larger each year. In fact, this year they passed the 1,000 exhibitors mark. Is it becoming unmanageable from your point of view?
It's becoming more difficult every year. I think there's two facets to this. I think that the trend is that the number of individual projects tends to be going down each year and the number of group projects is going up. And I think as judges, and I think our lingers will too, will want to investigate this and see, is this a good thing? The other question, which if I could just go back for a moment, on the question of numbers and groups, I think a case could be made for limiting the number of participants in a group. Some of these groups had the whole school working for them. And, you know, is this the way science is done? I don't think so.
I'm wondering, in view of a comment made by someone else, whether this mightn't be a good thing, because his objection was that this gives an opportunity to the cream of the country to exhibit, but what about the rather less qualified people below?
Well, on this thing, of course, you have, I mean, there are two types of people. There's the extrovert person and the introverted person. And, of course, you tend to get the people who are slightly extroverted coming to the science exhibition. There is a very large number of people who are not exhibiting or are not putting forward projects. And I think this is an area, I think, that has to be looked into. And I think by some scientific bodies are beginning to look into this area to see can something be done for these people. Maybe the idea might be to have some sort of regional exhibitions and then bring the winners from the regionals up to a smaller but better exhibition here in Dublin, the All-Ireland, if you like, of the science exhibitions.
You're one of the individual judges, Mr. Wilson.
That is correct, yes.
Now, how difficult is it to pick individual winners?
It's not difficult when you judge the individual by the standard of the projects that are presented. You usually find that an individual or perhaps a number of individuals stand out because of their scientific endeavour, and in that way it's fairly easy to pick the individual.
Where do you think this show can go from here? Has it reached the stage where it's going to become unmanageable with increasing numbers?
I don't think so. I think that already Aer Lingus have been reducing the number of exhibits coming by asking the teachers to select out. And I think this may have to go on perhaps on a greater scale to, in other words, only let the better ones come. I think that the exhibition as it stands, because it's done so well on an international basis, is now recognised as having a very high standard. And I think provided we can ensure that the high standard is maintained in the individual and group projects, then I don't see why we would want to change the format at all.
I asked Mr. Wilson what he thought of the allegation of undue teacher participation.
Well, you can sometimes suspect that a pupil or an exhibitor has had a tremendous amount of teacher help in his project. But we don't think that provided the pupil really understands his project in depth, that this in any way takes away from his exhibition. And you can often suspect teacher involvement, but I think this year, on every occasion when we suspected teacher or parent involvement, we were able to satisfy the entire panel that pupil really understood all the project in great depth, including mathematical formulae, calculations, etc., were appropriate. And therefore, whereas they may have had guidance, they really understood what the project was about.
I think if it's anything like my family, it's the children would be teaching the parents anyway.
In many cases, I think that's true.
A new development this year was the Young Scientist Workshop, aimed mainly at science teachers. The opening speaker was Professor E.T.S. Walton, Ireland's most distinguished senior scientist and Nobel Prize winner. I asked him for his views on the exhibition.
I've seen them now right from the start. I think it's a great thing to stimulate interest in young people because the whole future of the country really depends on development of technology and science.
When you were at school age, were you interested in science subjects?
Oh, yes.
And was there anything comparable at that time?
I was fortunate in that I was in a school where there was good science teaching. This can make a great difference to a person. But way back in those distant days when I was at school, the Board of Intermediate Education did make a serious effort to encourage teaching of science in the schools. And they had encouraged practical work. They used to send their inspectors round to inspect the practical work every year.
But really, Ireland didn't have much of a reputation as a scientific nation, possibly until your name surfaced.
Oh, no, that's not true at all. There have been some very, very, very distinguished...
There have been isolated ones.
Isolated, but you must remember the population of Ireland is small in comparison to the population of some of the larger European countries, and you can't expect the same number of outstanding people.
Do you think the standard is improving?
I do indeed, yes.
at all levels, including third level?
Yes, I think it is.
Do you think there's scope for much more improvement?
I'm not just sure what you're driving at here.
Well, I'm wondering if enough money is given to the teaching of scientific subjects.
But you'll never get people to admit they have enough money. They're always looking for more. But it's a question of whether you talk about teaching over a wider area or whether you're talking about taking subjects to a more advanced level. Now, I'm not sure which you had in mind when you asked.
Yes, well, what about both?
Well, I think both improvements have occurred.
And it's a continuing process?
I would hope so.
Coming up to 5 o'clock on judging day, excitement mounted. Everyone gathered round the platform, and Jack Miller of Aer Lingus effected the introductions.
EIYSE is just about to take off. It's my pleasure, first of all, to introduce to you those people who are on the platform. And to make it easy, I will start with the person, the lady on my right hand, that is your left, Dr. Deborah Donnelly, who represents our distinguished panel, our panel of distinguished judges.
The principal speaker was the Minister for Education, Mr. John Wilson.
It is very gratifying to see the extent to which pupils have involved themselves in science projects, whether as individuals or in groups. Aer Lingus is to be commended once more for providing this stimulus to pupils and for giving them this opportunity to display their work. The encouragement and motivation of pupils to participate in this exhibition depends to a great extent on the teacher. The size, scope, and quality of the entries is abundant proof of the educational value that teachers attach to it. They, however, are out of the limelight when the exhibition itself takes place. Their role confines them to the background. The pupils themselves are the principal investigators, with the teachers ever available to help, to challenge, and to inspire.
The Aer Lingus Young Scientist Exhibition 1978 was a success. Much of that success is due to the hard work of preparation, not alone by teachers and pupils, but by the organisers. Margaret Coyne is Education Officer with Aer Lingus.
Well, it's a very pleasant task. It's a lot of work, but I enjoy it thoroughly. We work right through the year on the Young Scientist Exhibition. We start almost immediately after one exhibition is over. We publicise it again. We communicate with the teachers. We get around to as many schools as possible. And the whole thing really starts again in January.
Isn't this striking while the iron is hot?
Indeed it is, because there's a lot of interest shown in the exhibition by teachers and schools and individuals following on the exhibition. They read about it in the papers, they see it on television, they hear it in the radio, so there's a lot of interest at that time, and we think that's an important time to communicate with the teachers and the students.
You circularise schools in the 32 counties?
We do indeed. We circularise all the schools in the 32 counties, and we visit as many schools as we can get to each year, also in the 32 counties, all of the 32 counties.
So it involves you and your staff in really round-the-year work?
It does indeed, yeah. As I say, we publicise it in January. We produce a sort of an outline brochure giving the basic details of the exhibition, and then we follow that on in May and June with the more detail, the greater detail of the project work, because a lot of the students like to have the long days during the spring and summer to work on their projects. They don't want to leave it until October, November.
What about the logistics of this? Actually, bring the children to Dublin, having to put them up, do you have to chaperone the girls?
No, we're not quite into that. We leave that in the capable hands of the teachers and the parents. We do organise accommodation for them. For the last 2 years, we've been organising accommodation in Jury's Hotel, which, as you know, is right beside the exhibition centre and the RDS, and it's very handy for teachers. We organise transportation for them with CIE, and we organise the accommodation, but we leave it to themselves after that.
Niall Weldon, the secretary of Aer Lingus, is the man in overall control. I asked him how long the exhibition had been running.
This is the 14th year. We've just completed our 14th exhibition. The first one was opened in 1965 by Sean Lamass, and in that year we had 230 entries.
This year?
This year we have over 1,000.
It's been a progression all the way.
A progression, with one exception. That was in 1968 when we had that awful foot and mouth disease, when in fact we had a very sharp drop in numbers. But apart from that year, it has been growing steadily all the time.
Well, a progression can't go on forever. Are you going to find yourselves in trouble?
I wouldn't say in trouble. Growth is a problem all the time. And to date, we've been able to address ourselves to it. And this year has brought additional problems. We had 1,100 entries. And that's as much as the Royal Dublin Society accommodation can cope with. So it now seems that we may have to go into a regionalisation of the exhibition. And
would this be provincial, or would it be in all the principal cities of the country?
I rather think it would be in about half a dozen cities throughout the island, and that would include Northern Ireland, of course. Following on the regional exhibitions, we would, of course, continue with the main exhibition in the Royal Dublin Society each year.
This involves you in quite an amount of money, both above and below the line.
Yes, indeed. We have an annual budget for our sponsorships. This is our main sponsorship, and we obviously have to look at the cost each year. We believe that we're getting extremely good value from the work that's been done by the exhibition, and it seems to us that for as long as the children and the teachers respond in the way they have responded over the past 14 years, we will feel obligated to keeping this thing going.